Hey everyone, episode number 3. Today I am talking to Rachel Colley about liquid democracy and the variant of liquid democracy that she researches called smart voting. And then we're also going to be talking about another project she works on called Itero, which is an interactive voting platform. Rachel is currently a PhD candidate under the supervision of Umberto Grandi and Laurent Perussel, working on the ARN project SCONE, which stands for Social Choice on Social Networks, best acronym ever, at an institute that name is in French, but the acronym is IRIT. Her main research area is decision-making in multi-agent systems, with a focus on computational social choice. In particular, she is interested in models of interactive democracy. Such models try to make collective decision-making more appealing and effective. This has led her to research models of delegative democracy, such as liquid democracy, which try to balance the drawbacks of direct and representative democracy. Yeah, so that's Rachel, and we'll talk to her now. Hey, Rachel. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So to start with, we're going to be talking about liquid democracy and the variant that your research is on called smart voting. But before we get into those, could you tell us what direct democracy is and what representative democracy is and the difference between those two and maybe the advantages and disadvantages of both models?
So in models of direct democracy, everyone has a vote on every single issue. This is good because you get everyone's opinions all the time, but it's very time consuming if you think that everything that happens in a parliament, every person in the country would have to vote on it. It's very time consuming to just go and vote even, but also to learn about every issue at hand. Representative democracy is more what we're used to in society these days of electing a politician who represents your geographic community, who then votes in the parliament on your behalf. So one of the cons for this, so it's no longer time consuming. You vote every 4 years, roughly, depending on where you live. So one of the drawbacks of representative democracy is that some people can feel underrepresented. So for example, where I grew up in the UK, it's always been the other party in power. So when they go out and vote every time there's an election, yet it feels like my vote's never being used for something that I want.
So it definitely seems like direct democracy really can only work, or at least with our current technology, can only work in very small communities, in a town where a few hundred people can gather once a week, all in the same town square. But as soon as you get to large countries with millions of people, you need some form of representative democracy. And that then comes with the issues you talked about. Would you say that things like referendums and plebiscites are a form of direct democracy embedded in representative democracy?
So, I mean, this does get around some of the issues, but again, at the same time, you need to make sure that everyone is well informed on the issue and there's strict guidelines. So some countries do referenda a lot of the time and it works very well for them, but also, as a legal point, like in the UK, the referendum that we had on Brexit, this wasn't actually part of law that they actually had to go through with it. And there was no clear idea of what it was going to look like at the time. So it's a good way to get an opinion on a certain issue of the whole population, which is representative. And again, for the Brexit vote, no matter how you feel about it, it did show a shot of people's opinion at that point in time from the whole electorate.
Yeah, I think Brexit wasn't a good type of question well suited for a referendum. I think in Australia a few years ago, we had a referendum on marriage equality, which I think was a much better fit for a referendum because it's mostly values based. There aren't complex economic or legal or international diplomatic arguments that people need to think about it and understand. It's just, do you think gay couples should be able to get married?
I think that's what's happening in representative democracy. So if you think about going to parliament, yes, they might debate things for a while, but when it comes to the vote, it's on a very clearly defined policy, whether it's therefore or against it. So if referenda looked like this, great. But I think in recent years, the Brexit vote in general. This was a not very well-defined vote, so it was very hard for people to have a yes-no opinion on something that was very grey.
So there's a lot of work on trying to make representative democracy better. So different voting systems and preventing things like gerrymandering. But we're not going to be talking about those today. We're going to be talking about another approach to generalize direct democracy and make it more feasible for large modern countries or organizations that hopefully will have some advantages over representative democracy. So what is liquid democracy? And also, I think there's another term I've heard is proxy voting. So also, is that the same as liquid democracy or are there differences? Yeah, just please tell us about this cool idea.
So with liquid democracy, proxy voting, so as with most things, the terms are used slightly differently all over the place. But I think the most general definition is that in proxy voting, it's more closely related to how we see representative democracy now. So there's a set of representatives that could be predefined, and then everyone else can either decide to vote for or against the issue at hand. So deciding that I know enough about this and I can vote, or you can give your vote to one of the representatives. Liquid democracy extends this a bit because we can start having these delegations be transitive. So what that means is that if I want to give my vote to someone else, they would vote on my behalf. And in turn, if they can't or they don't know how to vote on this issue, they would then maybe delegate it further to someone who they think is more expert on this issue than they are. And if that expert were to vote, they would receive all of the vote as their voting power. So essentially voting for three people instead of one.
Okay, so with proxy voting, it's like a one-step thing. So there's a group that may be elected by some other method, and you can directly vote or you can delegate your vote to one of the people in that group. But with liquid democracy, there can be chains of delegation where one person delegates to another person, and then that person delegates their own vote and the first person's vote to a third person, and it snowballs from there. So what is the argument for liquid democracy? Why would this be a better system for implementing democratic decisions compared to representative democracy?
So I think it really allows the people the ability to express how they want their votes to be counted. And that's what is attractive to me, because if, for example, it was about academia, or if it was about how university money should be spent, because I've spent so many years in university, I might have an opinion that I want to express with my vote. And so here I'd be free to vote for or against the issue at hand, or say I could delegate it to someone I trust. So say maybe my supervisor, who has lived here longer in France than I have and might have a clearer idea of what his vote should be, and I trust him to represent my own vote.
Something you brought up there was this idea of voting differently on different issues. So would the idea be that you don't just choose whether to directly vote or to delegate everything? You could do it on an issue by issue basis. If there's some issue you feel you don't know about and you have no expertise in, you can delegate your vote on that issue to someone who you trust more. But on a different issue that you do feel you know about and trust your own opinion on, then you can vote directly on that.
Yes, exactly. So the way I envision it happening in the real world would be there's some online portal which you log into securely, and then maybe you can set up for different, I don't know, subjects of the votes. So maybe for economics or immigration policy, you would choose your delegates for each of these things, or you could decide that I want to vote myself for these things. So you could have it such that every time there's a vote, someone has to input something. But the way I see it working in practice is that it's a little bit more predefined and you can make it as easy as you want it to be.
So has there been any real world implementations of liquid democracy?
So I think the most known or the largest implementation of this is the German Pirate Party. They think liquid democracy is the best way of making decisions. So at one point they were trying to, it's still quite a small party, but they were trying to make it more well known as a voting system. So they created some software called Liquid Feedback, which allows people to vote, and they used it for all their internal decision making, which was really cool. And I think this small low level use of collective decision making through an online platform is really nice to get people used to voting online, because I think that's the biggest problem with especially my field of research is that we look at all these nice models that have all these nice properties, but what's the point if people don't trust them or don't understand what's going on?
So was the idea with the Pirate Party, when they were deciding what votes their representatives in parliament should cast, they consulted their members of their party to decide how to vote on an issue?
So yes, I don't think they had any representatives in the parliament, but they had, so for all, so say what their stance is on a given issue for this political party, they would make all the decisions internally, or if they wanted to elect a new spokesperson, this would all be done internally. We had a workshop on liquid democracy and the French Pirate Party came and we had a spare 20 minutes or something. And they just were like, oh, we used liquid democracy for all of our internal decision-making processes. And then just, it was in the middle of the pandemic, so a Zoom workshop just showed us how it actually works. And it was a very interesting model of liquid democracy as well, where you could split your voting weight between different people. So it's quite an advanced model. It's not the basic model, but they liked using it and it was great.
Awesome. So that's liquid democracy. And there's a bunch of interesting research and different versions and refinements and variations. And one of those, the one that we're going to be talking about today, is called smart voting. So could you tell us what smart voting is and how it extends a liquid democracy?
So our smart voting model extends liquid democracy in two ways. So the first way is that we allow the delegation to include many agents. So what this means is that I can give a function if I want to and a group of agents to determine my own vote. So for example, if I know three experts on economics and I want the majority outcome of these three agents' vote to represent me. So you're giving more expected power to the voter themselves because maybe they don't trust each three of these people individually, but they think collectively, yeah, they'll have the right opinion that will reflect mine. And then the second aspect is we allow for ranked delegations. So what this means is it's a way to get around delegation cycles. So a delegation cycle is when, say, I delegate to you and you delegate back to me. How do we determine our vote in this situation? Because there's no information here. But if I had a secondary delegation, which was, you can think about it, is if my first delegation is caught in a cycle, then I can look to my second delegation and maybe this is to someone else. And now we can determine all of our votes through this.
Okay. So like we said with proxy voting, because there's only one step of the delegation, there isn't this issue with cycles. But because in liquid democracy, delegation chains can be arbitrarily long, you can have cycles where A delegates to B, who delegates to C, who then delegates back to A. So you get these delegation cycles. And to deal with that, you have these unraveling procedures, which are a way of deciding between or breaking these cycles so that you can still determine the vote at the end of the day. So on some of the criticisms or potential drawbacks of liquid democracy, one common one, I think, would be that it could lead to a real concentration of power. I feel like one advantage of representative democracy is that you vote for local people in your local geographical area, and then those people have to decide and talk and negotiate. I worry, for example, in the US right now, I feel like maybe if we use this liquid democracy transitive delegation cycle, then Trump might get 40% of the voting power and Bernie Sanders might get 30%. And I feel pretty quickly you could get four or five people with 90% of the voting power because of this stardom celebrity effect. Is that an issue? Do you think that is possible?
So there's no evidence to support this either way, but I think it could be a risk, but we also have no idea if it would. Because the way I see liquid democracy happening in practice, it will make politics a lot more local. So again, even though I might have a local representative, they have to follow, especially in the UK, they have to follow a party line. So essentially, it doesn't really matter who the person is because they have to follow the policy of their party. So this is also a concentration of power between two parties with two leaders. Whereas in models of liquid democracy, the chain can stop whenever someone wants to vote. So the way I see it, it could make it a lot more local. So if it's an education policy, maybe you delegate to the local, your child's school teacher, who, if it affects them, and then maybe they in turn delegate to their head teacher, who has said, I'm going to look into this. You don't have to delegate to me, but I'm going to work through all of this document and decide if I'm for or against. I'll let you know in my reasons. So I think it could make it a lot more local instead, especially on this issue-based, different issues on different subjects.
So that seems right if we assume that people could only delegate to people they know in person, or there was some kind of local condition on who you can delegate to, then you would get these kind of extended chains. But I feel if you could delegate to anyone, some people may delegate to the person that they know in real life, who they trust the most on politics, but I think a lot of people would delegate to the one of the two or three or five of the most politically visible people, your Donald Trumps, your Bernie Sanders, your AOCs, the political stars or celebrities. Do you disagree with that? Is that not how you think people would vote in practice?
I don't know exactly, but I do believe that it would become a bit more local. But even if there are some political celebrities, because in this sort of model, we wouldn't have the same kind of representation. I don't know. Again, I think even if the concentration of power goes to five people, this is better in the US than just Joe Biden and Trump being the only two people actually being able to make decisions for like the presidential election, say. And again, in the UK, it's the same thing. There are two parties that make all of the decisions. In, let's say, the Labour Party, there are like four or five different camps with lots of different opinions. And actually, it just depends who's in power of the party who gets all of this voting power.
So another issue with liquid democracy is that, as we discussed with direct democracy, it becomes increasingly infeasible when there's more and more people. So after a few hundred or a few thousand people, it becomes infeasible and you need to switch to representative. But in a liquid democracy model, let's say 90% of people choose to delegate and 10% of people choose to directly vote, or some reasonably large percentage like that. So in that case, you would still need the infrastructure to have all these people be able to directly vote on every parliamentary bill and government action. And I think logistically, the difference between having the option and ability for 10% of people to vote directly on everything, and compared to everyone voting directly on everything, it doesn't seem that much better. You still have millions of people voting on every single issue that needs to pass the equivalent of parliament in the system. So I think liquid democracy is meant to be the best of both worlds. A kind of compromise between direct and representative. But does that mean it could just have the same issues as both and be the worst of both worlds?
So I think there will be some of the logistical issues of direct democracy. But again, it's hard to say. So in models like Liquid Feedback, the German Pirate Party, they speak regularly with some of my colleagues in Berlin. And they, for example, like the idea of delegation cycles. Because this means that if you're in a large enough delegation cycle of people who have enough similarity between their political opinions, then it just needs one person in this cluster of people to vote on the issue and everything's fine. So there is still problems of it's going to be hard for people. So say every 3 days there's a new thing that has to be passed. It's still a lot. But I think also there's no way such a model can be implemented without it being completely computerized or being online. So that's like the biggest thing. Like even once every 4 years, people still complain about getting to the polling station. And it, like in the UK, it shuts at 10 p.m. So you have from 7 o'clock in the morning till 10 p.m. And yeah, people still complain about it.
It does seem like it needs to be digitized or done over the internet with computers in some respect. Do you have thoughts on how feasible that is in terms of computer security? My understanding is, I am very much not an expert, but my impression is that a lot of the computer security expert community are quite skeptical of whether we have the capabilities to run secure online elections in high stakes scenarios, like in politics. Do you agree with that? Is that something we need to look into more? Or do you think it is feasible to do it with the level of computer security capabilities we have at the moment?
So I think this is one of the biggest issues with implementation. So if you're doing something low level and very local and doing collective decision making online, then security isn't that much of an issue. So you hear about it on small participatory budgeting campaigns. Like maybe they see it as someone trying to attack the system and put in 1,000 votes or whatever. But usually on this sort of level, you can see what's coming into the database that's storing all this information and remove it or do what you need to. Whereas for a national level vote, it becomes so much harder. I think the theoretical research is almost there. So there's a paper called Statement Voting, and I've forgotten who it's by, but it's a really nice paper, and our model of smart voting can be implemented through this, and it talks about different protocols to put voting on a blockchain, and so it would be completely decentralized and you could check at every step what's happened, if anything weird's gone on. Yeah, but I think it's hard. But also some countries already vote online and have a little device where they put their ID, attach it to their computer, and then they can do all of their government business through the computer as well. So it's not just voting. They can, I don't know, look at their state pension or everything like this. So if we're going to have to digitize for things such as, I don't know, seeing how much you're paying in your taxes online to really secure this, then wouldn't such a system also be secure enough to vote? But it is hard. And I think people just don't trust online systems, because at least with a paper ballot that someone's gone through or a group of people have gone through and it's been checked multiple times by lots of different people, that the right number of bits of paper with a cross in a certain box are in one pile and another. It's very easy to explain as well. I think that the two biggest things going forward is explainability of how these new systems work. So not just for liquid democracy, but in general. So in participatory budgeting, some of the most efficient rules of using the budget are harder to explain. So this is a huge part of getting people to trust the system and being able to explain these complex things to people in a very digestible way. Because also, why should I be changing from a very simple first past the post system to something a lot more complicated when I don't understand why we're doing it? What are the benefits? And then the second part is that we really have to get trust into computer systems. I think it doesn't help that in the news you hear about things being hacked all the time, our data being used, this sort of thing. Government, so in the UK, the National Health Service, databases sometimes just get hacked. Why should I be trusting my vote with the government if they can't look after my medical data?
Just one more question I wanted to ask you was, if we see liquid democracy as a third approach meant to be the best of both worlds compared to direct and representative democracy, another third approach that seems interesting to me is this idea of citizens' assemblies, or also called sortition. So the idea is that you randomly select a group of, say, 1,000 voters, and they act almost like a parliament. It would be similar to jury duty, where you're randomly selected, then you go for some period of time and deliberate and make decisions and directly vote on bills. And I think the idea is that in the same way, the justification for representative or liquid democracy is partly that not every voter has the time to have an opinion on every issue, and the influence of any one voter is very small. So it's probably not even rational for them to spend a large amount of time deciding or coming to the correct conclusion on every issue. So you let voters delegate or vote for a representative. So if you had citizens' assemblies, then everyone who is not in the assembly can just ignore politics and everyone in the Citizens Assembly, because they are one of, say, 1,000 voters in the whole country, it actually is worth for them to work and study and become full-time experts and spend a significant amount of time thinking about these issues. And because of the random selection, ideally the Citizens Assembly would approximate the decision of what the entire populace would vote for if they had the time to study and deliberate and discuss and reflect and think about the issues being voted on. But yeah, what do you think about this idea of citizens' assemblies?
So for me, coming from in my undergrad, I did some political philosophy. So moving to things like sortition from citizens' assemblies, something that doesn't sit right with me is that we lose this idea of one person, one vote. So this is the idea that everyone gives something up and deserves a say in the final, what's going on in some way in the democracy. So whether that be choosing a representative or voting directly. I think citizens' assemblies and sortitions are useful as part of liquid democracy. I think this is a nicer way. So using, say, citizens' assemblies to come up with the policies in hand. So using this in a model of liquid democracy where there are members of parliament or representatives in the same sort of way, but randomly choosing people to come up with the policies at the time and then everyone still gets to vote. This sounds really reasonable and a nice use of citizens' assemblies. But also with the sortitions of randomly picking people, there are some models of proxy voting. There's a very old paper that I haven't found the reference for, but I can, where the sortition picks the proxies. So picks the representatives and then everyone just gets to choose the person in the sortition who they think represents them the most. So this also makes sense that not everyone who's randomly selected, because with the random selection, you might happen to have a disproportionate amount of people from different social economic classes and race and gender and this sort of thing.
That's a really interesting point about the political philosophy question of citizens' assemblies and whether delegating voting power to the randomly selected group would violate this concept of one person, one vote, and everyone having a say. I guess my argument would be that because of the law of large numbers and assuming the randomization selection process is fair and isn't corrupted, and the assembly is of a decent size, and there are things you could do to make sure that it's representative of the population. So you could do like stratified random sampling, where to make sure that the proportion of people of different genders or races or geographical locations or income or education levels are all as close as possible to the empirical distribution of the actual full electorate. But yeah, because of the law of large numbers, you would expect that the votes of the assembly would be the same or approximately the same as all the people if they were given the vote. So yeah, it's an interesting question. It's like if you, instead of democracy, if you had a magic box that outputted the same vote as what people would vote for if they could vote, and then you just do everything this box says. On the one hand, all the decisions and government actions are going to be the same, theoretically. But on the other hand, people aren't actually voting themselves. Yeah, it's an interesting philosophical question, I guess, whether that counts as a democracy. But yeah, I want to find an advocate for citizens' assemblies and sortition at some point and bring them on. So future episode, stay tuned. Okay, so before we get to the unraveling procedures, on the issue of the ballots for smart voting, so because of the high amount of expressiveness that you let voters put in their smart ballots, I think you mentioned in the paper that deciding whether a smart ballot is valid or needs to be thrown out is either NP hard or NP complete, one of those.
I think NP complete. So this is hard because you have to check certain features of the ballot. So we want to make sure that in these ranked delegations that every delegation given by a sanction isn't secretly a vote for or against. So saying that I want it to be your opinion or not your opinion, which is a tautology and it's true all the time, no matter what you say. So we want to avoid this, but in doing so, we're essentially stat solving all the time. And we want to check that no two functions for different ranks of the delegation. So my first delegation and my second delegation, we want to make sure that none of these are the same. So you're not going to cheat the way that we're trying to find outcomes by just making sure that your first delegation is always being used, because it's logically equivalent to your first, your second, your third, your fourth. And then the ranks don't really mean anything in this sort of situation.
And yeah, so because the language is so expressive, people, if they wanted to, could just troll, basically, and put crazy long formulas where you have to say things like, okay, if this number is prime, then I vote this way. And if it's not prime, I vote this other way. But I don't actually think that would be an issue in practice, because if it's only the validating of the ballot that is NP complete, you could just say, hey, we're going to use this much computation to verify your ballot or to validate your ballot. And if we can't prove that it's valid with that much computation power, we're just going to throw it out. And because only people trolling would submit a ballot, I think, that would be computationally hard, because it's only in the worst case that it's NP complete.
Yeah, so it's only in the worst case that it's hard. I think that's correct. And also, it seems very difficult. And most people are not going to give a huge logical formula to express how they want their delegation to be determined. I think this is a really important point, that in our model, yes, you can use a Boolean function to describe your delegation, but all we wanted to do is take this to the most extreme expressive language. And then it's down to the agent themselves, the voter, to decide what they want their vote to represent. And so there's no restrictions on the agents. But I mean, in practice, we're probably going to be, if this person or this person is for, then I'm also for, or the majority rule, or things like this, which are very easy to understand.
Okay, so on the issue of delegation cycles, so we have this problem where if delegations are transitive, you can have cycles where A delegates to B, who delegates to C, who then delegates back to A. And your solution to that is these unraveling procedures. And I think you have six different ones that you outline. So yeah, could you tell us what those unraveling procedures are? Maybe talk about the differences between them, although we might not be able to get too much into those technical details on this podcast without a whiteboard and a bunch of math. But yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Okay, so the unraveling procedures take these very complex ballots and then turn them into votes for everyone. So a direct vote for or against. When we aren't looking at the ranked procedures, the ranked ballots, if you just have a single delegation, then all of the unraveling procedures are the same. So we have two types of unraveling procedures. We have optimization procedures that are either trying to minimize the sum of the rank being used in everyone's ballots, an egalitarian procedure, which is also an optimization procedure, which is trying to minimize the maximum rank used for any agent. And then we have some tractable procedures as well, which are just iterative procedures trying to find outcomes. And these either differ in that there's either work by randomly choosing someone at a certain rank to use their delegation to resolve cycles, or having a preference for someone having a direct vote over there being a delegation at a certain rank position.
So there's two that are optimal but computationally hard. And then there's these four other ones which can be non-optimal but can be solved quickly. Like the unraveling procedure can terminate quickly. So the two optimal ones, do they always reach the same answer, or do they reach different ones also?
Yeah, they reach different ones. So the minimizing the sum of the rank being used, we showed in our journal paper version of this paper we're talking about, that is Pareto optimal. So if it's a solution to minimizing the sum of the rank being used, then what this means is that no one can do any better without making someone else worse, essentially.
And then the other one, it's kind of a mini-max, almost Rawlsian notion, where instead of trying to maximize the sum of welfares of the different voters, we're trying to make the worst off person the least worst off as possible.
Yeah, so with this, you might have everyone being able to use their first delegation, But in order to break the cycle, we have to use someone's 10th delegation. So this isn't really that fair because someone has to use something which is their 10th delegation. And also globally, this might not be something we want because we're having to use, in order for everyone else to use their first delegation, we'll have to use someone's 10th, which they will trust a lot less. It's the 10th thing that they trust instead of the first, the second or third. So wouldn't it be better if we kept everyone's delegation being used as minimal as possible?
Do you have preferences between those two? One that you like better?
I think it's, so min sum is good. So minimizing the sum of the ranks. I think this is a very natural thing to study, but I think in places, the more egalitarian approach is a lot better because it's a bit more community focused rather than just trying to solve a computer science problem as efficiently as possible. It has a bit more, it's a bit more principled.
And then the other ones, I think we probably won't get into the differences between the other four, but they all use randomness partly. So we're moving from a deterministic voting system to a random voting system. Not random in the sense of every option being equally likely, but there being some randomness such that if you run the exact same election twice, you're not guaranteed to reach the same outcome. So do you think that now that the voting procedure has randomization in it, that some of the criticisms of randomized voting methods now suddenly apply, such as people thinking it's unfair or, yeah, at least perceiving that it's unfair, even though maybe we can define sensible notions of fairness for randomized voting procedures. I think the general public might still have the perception that randomness used in this way is unfair.
Yeah, so I can understand why people would, again, people would only think it was unfair if they were the person who was being chosen by this like random lottery to break the cycle with a very unfavorable delegation of theirs. But also at the same time, if they didn't agree with this delegation, then they shouldn't have included it in their ballot. I think this is also something you should be happy, although you have a ranking over these delegations, you should be happy with any of them being used. So although it might be unfair that you can't have your first delegation, we found an outcome, which I think is the important thing. And you listed everything that you trusted.
Yeah. And because you can always, in the smart ballot, you always have a default, which is your direct vote. So if you rank someone above your direct vote, then that's on you. If you didn't want your delegation to possibly go to them, then you should have just not ranked them at all and put in, instead of them, put in your direct vote higher. Do you know to what extent delegation cycles would appear in practice? Are there any computer simulations of the system or things like that?
So I know actually that there are quite a few people in the field who are trying to do experiments on liquid democracy to study things like how often do delegation cycles work in practice. This is something that we have no idea how it would work or if this even would work in practice, or if it's just something that's a theoretical problem that we're just constantly going over and finding new solutions to. So I'm very excited for hopefully seeing there'll be some experimental research on this.
As with every voting system, there's a bunch of different criteria that we can define and see which voting systems pass or fail them. So you introduced two new criteria for liquid democracy, caste participation and guru participation. So what are those and are they satisfied by the different unraveling procedures?
These participation properties came from a paper by Kutsalaru and Riley, which they look at ranked delegations in liquid democracy. So they don't have this multi-agent aspects of their delegations, but we tried to take from their work and show in our work what they would look like in our new model and if they still hold. So caste participation, what this means is that if someone's giving a direct vote, so they know what to do in the situation to vote for or against the issue, they have no incentive to give any other type of ballot. This is a nice idea because we're not allowing people to manipulate for no reason. If they know how they should vote on this issue, then they should just vote and not be trying to cause cycles or doing anything else. And in our paper, we showed that two of our tractable procedures, the unraveling procedures, do satisfy it on the same domain as them. So liquid democracy without the ranked liquid democracy, where the final backup vote is an abstention, when we consider any monotonic rule, so say the majority rule. And then for guru participation, this is now looking at the receiving of delegations. An unraveling procedure has the property of guru participation if there's always an incentive to receive delegations and accept them. Unfortunately, though, in our model, because we can have negative delegations, so I can say that I want my vote to represent the opposite of what yours is. This becomes a lot harder in our model. But even on ranked liquid democracy with an abstention, this isn't the case in our new model. So this differs from the result from the previous work, but this is due to some slight differences in the model of how we treat abstentions. We treat it as any other vote, whereas in the other paper, they treat it as something to be avoided in the mechanism.
Ah, okay. That's really interesting. I read the part about guru participation not being satisfied, and that was quite surprising. I was trying to think of why that would be the case, but I hadn't thought that you can just use your vote to negate someone else's vote. You can just say, hey, whatever that person votes for, I vote for the opposite, which is like hilarious. Okay, so moving on to potential criticisms of smart voting. Do you think that the smart ballot allowing not just people to rank in delegations of individuals, but letting them use these complex functions, do you think that adds much value for the extra complexity? Like, how much do you think voters would use these added features? Or are we just making the system more complicated and harder to explain without a sufficient amount of additional value being generated?
So in the journal version of the paper, we did show that our two optimal procedures, when restricted to ranked liquid democracy with an abstention at the backup vote, our two optimal procedures become tractable. So moving to this really expressive setting where people can give functions really does increase the complexity of how hard it is to find solutions. I have no idea if people would actually be using this expressiveness, but the goal of our paper was to give the most general idea as possible. And then, as we do in the paper, like study different formats of liquid democracy, which are slightly less than this very general model, and show what the differences are, because maybe you wouldn't want to use smart voting all of the time, but ranked liquid democracy instead. I think it's a nice idea to give this expressivity. And also, why not try it for a little bit on small groups, see if people are actually using it? Because if you think about just trying to organize a dinner amongst friends, giving a single delegation might not express, but you could use the smart voting model to say, I only really want to go to dinner with this big group of friends if my five closest friends are going. So I could express an opinion to say, I'll go if and only if my five closest friends go. And you could have nice uses like this.
That reminds me, I really liked the poster that you had for your smart voting paper. Listeners, I'll put the link in the description. But I like that, for one, you have the people who are voting. They're these colored humanoid stick figures instead of just letters like ABC. I thought that was nice. And your examples of the choice being going to dinner and the little pictures of the different dinner options. Yeah, I thought that was really cool.
The poster was created in the middle of the pandemic, where the idea was cook at home or get a takeaway. So middle of a confinement lockdown, am I really into at the moment, either cooking dinner or getting a takeaway?
Something you said was that, I think you said that the backup vote, I thought that the backup vote had to be a direct vote, but I think you mentioned earlier that there's an alternative system where the backup vote is an abstention. So yeah, is that right? What's the difference between those two versions?
It depends on what the language of the ballots are. But so the effort you have for the backup vote. So if you're dealing with a Boolean function, then it has to be a 0 or 1. But in models of ranked liquid democracy, then it can be an abstention, which takes some of the pressure off. But I think there are models which we didn't explore where the backup vote could be an abstention and everything would still work properly. But unfortunately, we didn't look into this at the time. But so although it might seem quite hard to come up with a backup vote and give all these delegations, you could think of this backup vote being that should this bill be passed or not? So having a backup vote is a zero, sort of like the status quo. So do I want change or do I want things to stay as they are? So you can think about it like this.
Okay, cool. Because I was going to ask, by requiring everyone to have a backup vote, it seems to partially remove the advantage of not needing everyone to have to think about the issues themselves if they still need to put a backup. By writing down that backup vote, they still need to put in the cognitive labor to decide on what their direct vote will be. But with that framing you just said, that's interesting. So the backup vote being an abstention, or having it that the default assumption is the bill not passing, which is something you see a lot in various constitutional things where there's a default choice of no change or no action that may need a certain threshold, which might be higher than a simple majority to reach in order for the presumption of inaction to be overcome.
Sorry, something to add to the last point. I think what's also interesting is that if you, say, are trying to vote on a particular issue and you only have 20 minutes to read through everything very quickly before you can just submit your vote, then it's also a level of trust that you have in yourself. So saying, okay, here's my group of experts. Hopefully this will work. The delegation of this will go through. There'll be no cycles. But if not, then I have spent 20 minutes and I do think it should be four. So I think the ranked delegations do give you a level of, I trust this the most, this second, and so on and so forth. So it's quite nice having this idea of the backup vote to be like, I'm not sure, but this is roughly what I think. And you have some sort of safety net of the delegation as well.
Okay, so I think we might move now to the second paper of yours that I wanted to talk about, which is Itero, an online interactive voting application. So can you tell us first what is interactive voting? And then we'll talk about, this cool application you made for it.
So in general, interactive voting is trying to make voting procedures more interactive, as it says in the name, but trying to get people more involved. For one example is iterative voting. So what this means is that we have different rounds where at every round you get to say what your favorite candidate is. So say, for example, you're trying to decide when a meeting should be on a particular day. In each round, you can vote with which of the time slots you think is going to be the best for you. Going from one round to the next, you get to see the results from the previous round. So say you want it first thing in the morning and that most of the people want it in the evening in the first round, then maybe you'll be like, okay, I'll try putting it at lunchtime and try and have a compromise going on and so on. So what's nice about it is that it's a very explainable model that you see the results and you get to react to them. But the voting is just that you give a single approval to one of the candidates for our voting model. And the different rounds mean that what is usually considered a bad thing, manipulation, being able to change your vote to try and change the outcome, essentially means that you get to approximate a ranked voting scenario, but in a very explainable way for people where they just have to give a single vote and react. So if in the first round, your first preference candidate is very low in the ranking, then maybe in the second round, you'll try your second highest ranked candidate and so on. But you remove the sort of cognitive labor of actually going through and having to list everything in a ranking and then putting it into a voting rule. And then also this voting rule, the people might not understand how it's actually working, whereas we can all understand a plurality vote.
So in some real world elections, like I believe in the French presidential system, you have these runoff rounds where, say in France, everyone, you'll first run an election with a first past the post system. So everyone votes for just one candidate. And then the top two are selected for a second round. And then everyone can vote a second time some weeks later for one of those top two candidates. And then a lot of ranked voting systems try to simulate this process with many rounds. So the instant runoff voting, which is used in Australian elections, the idea is in each round, you want to eliminate the least popular candidate, the one that's furthest away from winning, and then let the voters who voted for that candidate redistribute to their second preference. And you could do that theoretically by having one round for each candidate and having people vote many times. But in large national elections, that's obviously infeasible. And that might work for small groups of people. But in large national elections, that's not feasible. So you get voters to rank every candidate and submit their whole ranking all at once. And then you simulate this runoff process using people's rankings. So when one candidate is eliminated, everyone who had that candidate ranked first, you now look to their second preferences. But in the settings where we'd be using this Itero system, I assume that the rounds would be relatively short. And yeah, we would only use the system for situations where that would be feasible. Is there a set number of rounds or a set number of times that you can switch your vote? Or can you just log in at any time and look at the current totals and then change your vote if you want to? Yeah, what's the setup that you used?
So this was one of the, so in theory, it's just that everyone, you can imagine them sat in a room and everyone votes at the same time and puts their vote into a box. It's counted, the results are given, and then everyone just keeps on going till. Also, in theory, you might have a set number of rounds, or you might just carry on going until the vote converges and no one wants to change their vote anymore, which isn't practical when you're trying to create a voting platform. So this was something that we really had to think about when creating the platform. First of all, how do we define a round? If someone doesn't log in at the right time, what happens? If someone, say, you set the round to be 4 hours long. So you tell everyone Monday morning, 10 o'clock until 2 p.m., we're doing the first round. After two, we'll start the second round and so on. But what do you do if someone doesn't log in for the first round? What happens if someone misses the second round? So it's not that they go in and keep their vote the same and do the same vote, but they just don't log in at all. What happens to their vote? So we've tried to make it as expressive as possible for the person creating the poll so they can decide a lot of these things. If someone doesn't vote between rounds, should their vote be changed to an abstention or should they keep the vote from the previous round? How long should a round be? Should they be able to say, if everyone has voted in a given round, that's the end of this round and the next round can then begin? So we've tried to allow the creator of the poll to be able to just decide all of this for themselves.
And are candidates eliminated in each round, or does every candidate stay until the final and the people voting will just notice that the candidate that they like in the first round, they can see that candidate only got 1% of the vote. So they think to themselves, okay, well, my favorite candidate isn't going to win. I'll switch my vote to a candidate I like less, but has a higher chance of eventually being the winner.
Yeah, exactly. So if you really didn't want to change your vote, the candidates don't disappear round by round. So if you really wanted the meeting to be at 9 o'clock in the morning, you could keep your vote consistently at 9 o'clock in the morning for all of the rounds. But your vote might not mean much when actually, if you vote for 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, then maybe more people would be interested in moving slightly earlier in the day.
And I guess an advantage of that would be that because you can see the popularity of the candidates in each round, that means that people can tell which of the candidates are going to be the few that might end up winning and then can direct their time to researching those candidates. So if there's 20 different candidates in the first round, you can just vote for your favorite. And then you see that maybe 3 or 4 of the 20 have most of the votes. You don't have to then research all 20 candidates. You can just spend the remainder of the voting time you have looking more in depth into those top candidates and choosing your favorite amongst them. And in a lot of the settings where you would be using this, I presume there wouldn't be opinion polls where everyone already has an idea. Like in the US presidential election, everyone knows what the top two candidates will probably be. If a group of, in this setting, in a group of friends or a business or something similar, you don't know necessarily, or you don't have that clear of an idea of what the top few options are going to be. So this like serves as an opinion poll and a voting system combined into one, which is, yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. It's really nice to see this, hopefully in practice. Like we saw some fun voting behavior. And I think it does really, it really helps people make compromises. So it's very hard, especially, I don't know, if you're trying to do a single transferable vote, like we were talking about earlier, where you rank the candidates until you no longer agree. Say, when you see the iterations happen, none of the people you actually agree with have enough to progress to the next round or whatever, but your vote no longer counts. So maybe in this situation, in an iterative voting, if you see someone on the other end of the political spectrum to you gaining a lot of power, you would start moving your vote to people who you don't necessarily agree with, but they represent you a lot more than someone who's gaining a lot of traction.
Do you worry that there could be bandwagon effects? Like, I think this is already a bit of an issue where people don't vote for a candidate that they think is going to lose. I think I've seen some data in US elections that suggest that if a candidate is far enough behind, they'll lose even more. Like, there's this effect where people don't like voting for a candidate that is going to lose. Yeah, do you think that's an issue, that if after the first round, the voters will see that one candidate has the most votes and everyone will just rush to them and be like, oh, they must be great, I guess I'll vote for them. Yeah, is that an issue, do you think?
I think the iterative voting, what's quite nice is that if you have a set number of rounds, so say we're not going to have any less than 10 rounds, then you can play about with your vote and explore the space whilst everyone else is. And then you can make sure if trying everything else to try and get someone a bit closer to your political position to have more votes, you can at the last minute change your vote to someone else. So it could happen, but I think there's a lot more, the stakes are a lot lower round by round. So the chances to explore the space and see what everyone else is doing is a lot higher.
In the real world implementation where you ran this, what was the pattern of votes like? Were there candidates that, say, went down, but then later went back up, like fluctuations like that? What did the changes from round to round look like in practice?
So we've used it a few times. So we've tried it internally a few times, which is always quite nice. And then we've also tried it for the workshop we ran that I was speaking about earlier. So I think the workshop is a nicer example. So the question being asked was, which was the best talk of the day? So just to use the platform. And so the votes were really fluctuating at first, but once first place was found, everyone was exploring the space to make sure that, say, their second place was where they wanted it to be, and their third and their fourth, which I think is interesting, but also trying to make sure that everyone had enough votes so no one felt bad about their talk. It was a really nice thing because you could see people still moving about and it roughly evened out. But when the first place, which was the best talk of the day, was the sort of decided and solid, everything else evened out of it. It shows the nice side of people.
Yeah, that's super awesome. And also, yeah, that's a really interesting setting that's different from quite a lot of voting settings, because you want the best talk to be the winner, but you probably don't want it to win by too much. Yeah, you probably want every talk to win some amount of vote so no one feels too sad and left out. So yeah, you might notice that if the talk you think was the favorite is already winning, you might want to put your vote to a talk that has very few votes but you thought was pretty good. Not the best, but deserving of some amount of votes. That's really like adorable, wholesome setting. So when implementing this, did you learn anything or come up with any ideas from implementing it that you hadn't thought of or hadn't considered when you were just on the theory side, just like thinking about this type of system in the abstract?
So I mentioned that a little bit before, but again, how the rounds were one of the main things that were really hard to define as how do people actually want to be using the round? Because usually when we think about voting, it's one instant to the next. So time t equals one, time t equals two, and so on and so forth as a computer scientist. But in practice, if you send the link to everyone, some people might not get to their emails until the afternoon or only look straight before work and then they miss it. And you want to allow everyone to participate. But all of these like fine-grained things are really hard to actually put into practice and make sure the system allows the flexibility.
And did the users enjoy the experience? Did you get positive user feedback?
At the moment, yes. We've had a few blips where like university server crashed when we tried to do a demo once and the standard things that happen. But yeah, generally it's been quite positive. I think for most people from the theoretical side, it's nice to see something being put into practice because we haven't had much opportunity yet to actually use the platform and do fun things with it, do experiments. But it's now there as a tool. So if anyone wants to use it, you're free to. The code's freely available on GitHub if you want to make alterations for however you want it to be. But it's there to be used and you can do experiments on it in a lab if you wanted, just to give some structure that everything's on a computer screen instead of paper ballots.
And listeners, there will be a link to this application, the website that you can use for this in the show notes. So you can go out and use it tomorrow, next time you're in a group that wants to make some kind of decision. Tell us how it goes. With the experience of designing the website and user interface, what was that like? Did you do the coding yourself, or were there other more software types that you worked with?
So we had a postdoc working with us who was working on the actual implementation, and me and my supervisor and Umberto were there trying to guide the theory, but there was a constant back and forth between what's practical for people and what will people actually use, and some things that we like theoretically we want to see put into practice, but realistically who's going to be using them to decide when their weekly meeting should be. So there was a constant back and forth, but Zoj was in charge of actually creating the platform, and he had a group of students for an internship for a month, maybe 2 months, who worked on a mobile version of the site, which is great. So it's really easy to use.
Do you think that in this general area of social choice and mechanism design, I feel that there are a lot of ideas that are very much locked in academic papers that aren't implemented anywhere in practice? And that's a motivation for this podcast. So yeah, do you think that trying to implement a real world version of things like this and test it out and get user feedback and all of those things is something that should be done more in this space by academic researchers? And yeah, do you personally plan to do more experiments like this for the smart voting that we were talking about, for example?
So yeah, I do think sometimes we're, as academics in theory, too stuck in this is a nice computer science problem that we can solve, but mainly doing it as an application of solving some nice problem. When in fact we are studying voting models in this domain, which is something really widely acceptable, widely applicable. So it's widely applicable and can really impact how people's lives work in the future. So I do think implementing voting platforms is a really useful thing, especially when it's a tool for people to use. And like I was saying before, people aren't comfortable with voting online, which we're going to have to probably progress with this at some point, because our voting methods haven't changed generally in hundreds of years, which is, if technology has improved, then why not have a more efficient way of doing things in other aspects of our life? So I think this type of platform is really good for outreach. So if you think about Doodle, this is a collective decision-making platform. And even my mum, who isn't really related to my work at all, she was like, oh, I did a Doodle poll today with work to decide when the staff outing was going to be. And I was like, that's great. That's collective. And everyone trusts the system because they made it very explainable. And you can really see what's happening. Yeah, why not? Why not get people comfortable with slightly different voting mechanisms? Because I think the clearest example of this is participatory budgeting, where lots of people and municipalities were working on campaigns, and there were very successful campaigns with lots of money behind them, but didn't really know that computational social choice as a field even existed. And in fact, the rules can be just transferred across. And although, so the sort of greedy approach where you just take the most popular item, second most popular, and so on, might not use the budget as effectively as possible and might not maximize satisfaction in some way. So I think this sort of low-level vote, so not taking it to who should be our political leader in a country straight away, I think that's too fast. But start with these grassroots low-level things, and maybe one day we'll get there, especially when things like security have improved for online voting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the decisions or elections that are the most influential or have the most important real-world outcomes are the ones you want to bring online last. With the amount of actors and the amount of people with power and resources that would really want to affect, say, the US presidential election is probably very high. The amount of people who want to decide where me and my friends go to lunch is probably not that high. And then things like the participatory budgeting you mentioned, which is done on a city level and spending several million dollars, but not several billion, would be like in between those. There, hopefully, no giant hacker group really cares that much about whether a town in France builds a playground or a skate park. We probably want to have this digitizing of voting implemented in order of least important to most important, so we have practice. So again, the US presidential election is probably one of the last elections I would be comfortable moving to fully online, because by putting less consequential elections online first, we can gain a lot of knowledge and practice with implementing computer security.
But also there are ways of checking for security. If you have 1,000 votes coming in 3 seconds, all with similar ballots or just completely random coming from the same IP address or whatever, it's a lot more manageable to work out what's hacking on this sort of level when in total there's only going to be maximum 500,000 votes.
Yeah. Or if you get 1,000 votes all with the same birthday.
Or like subsequent birthdays, the 1st of January and 2nd of January and so on.
Okay. So my last question is just, what are you working on at the moment in terms of, can you give us any previews of the work you're doing that may be released in the next year or two? What problems are you trying to solve? What extensions to the ideas we've talked about today are you thinking about?
At the moment, I'm still working in liquid democracy on a few papers. So I recently had a paper on liquid democracy with multiple issues. So when you have a constraint saying that if you want your ballot to respective budgets or something like this, or you can create your own constraint for what you want your final votes to represent when inconsistencies can come from the different delegations. So I've been working on this as an extension, the other sort of side of the design. So instead of making the ballots more complicated, it's just making the vote itself more complicated, so with multiple issues. Going forward, I'm still working on different areas of liquid democracy. So what can I talk about? So some of the things I'm going to be working on moving forward on liquid democracy is looking at different voting power measures. So this has already been studied a little bit, but going forward, looking at different ways this can be done.
And that ties into the concentration of power thing we were talking about earlier, right? So to try to like measure if a guru gets this many delegations, how much of the total voting power do they end up having?
Yeah, exactly. And from a different side, so coming with discussions from the German Pirate Party with my colleagues in Berlin, what happens with long-term delegations? So really, we want to set up a system and we can't. So with long-term delegations, we want to set up a ballot which will suffice for the next year, say, so you're not constantly going in and changing it. Obviously, you're free to go in and change whenever you want, but to really make use of the fact that it isn't direct democracy, you don't have to keep on changing. What possibly can we be doing to make it easier and max how the utility that you have from your delegation? But going away from liquid democracy, I've also been working on other voting platforms. So we had a campaign for the French presidential election called Mon Programme, which allowed, it was a voting platform where we had 120 proposals from the manifestos of the different presidential candidates. And we asked users to both give a ranking and approval of different these proposals and different sets of thighs, and just study them to see what the general population is feeling and if the collective program from the users represents what actually happening in the political debates that were happening, stuff like this. So we're still, it's an ongoing project. We want, now we have the platform set up, it's really easy to move to different places. So hopefully we'll be trying in a few different countries as well. And then we'll start comparing like user behavior in different countries, even though the proposals are generally the same, which is nice. So what's nice about this is that it's not a recommender system. So it's not trying to tell you who you should be voting for. It's more about what should the collective government program be from the pool of users. So this is more saying collectively, what do we all agree on? What are the most consensual proposals? What are the most divisive proposals? So this could lead public discussions. If the most controversial discussion proposal is something like, I don't know, give more money to the military, then this should be something we should be talking about in public debate or amongst the candidates on the TV. This should be something that we should be seeing, because this is what's really dividing our population.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Also, I totally feel like the data you would get from that would just be super interesting in terms of looking at what issues correlate with other issues and with demographics and those kind of things. And yeah, and again, a good use of real world applications, which we love to see here at the Institutional Design Podcast. So yeah, thank you so much, Rachel, for coming to talk to us. I'll have to interview again in a year or two to hear about all that cool stuff. But yeah, thanks a ton for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's been a really interesting discussion. Thanks.